Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do so many people refuse to believe that William Shakespeare actually wrote all the plays and poetry published under his name? There is no evidence that his Jacobean contemporaries ever doubted Shakespeare's claim to authorship, but by the early 20th century, luminaries as diverse as Helen Keller, Sigmund Freud, and Mark Twain were firmly in the anti-Stratfordian camp, which proposed no fewer than 50 alternative authors for the various works credited to Shakespeare. Brilliant as those doubters were in their fields, my guest today is firmly convinced they were also entirely wrong. We'll talk about why in a minute. But what really interests him is why they embraced these alt-Shakespeare theories in the first place. James Shapiro is Larry Miller Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. His new book is called Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Great to be talking with you.
What are the chief arguments against Shakespeare having written all these things?
There are really two separate arguments. One is against Shakespeare, and the other are those in favor of alternative candidates. The argument against Shakespeare has to do with what information we now have about William Shakespeare, the man who was born in 1564 and died in 1616. And the problem for a lot of people is that the information we have doesn't line up with the great genius who wrote these plays.
What do we know about him as a man?
We know all the kind of things we don't want to know. The stuff we do want to know, we just don't know. What kind of husband, father he was, how did he go about writing his plays? Those are things that are lost to time for him and for pretty much everyone who lived back then. The things we know about him are the kind of things that would survive about any of us today. Real estate records, baptismal records, birth, death, and the like. So we know a lot about Shakespeare as a professional actor and as a member of a terrific theater company, the Chamberlain's Men, later the King's Men, with whom he performed for a good part of his adult life. And those confirm for us, if confirmation were needed, that he was indeed the author of these plays and poems.
Yeah, you think it's very clear that he knew and understood actors and that that had a lot to do with how brilliantly he wrote for them.
Yeah, Shakespeare had an unusual career. Very few people today are full-time actors and full-time writers. Shakespeare's typical day in the 1590s, once he joined his company, was to spend his mornings rehearsing that day's play. They'd break for lunch and in the afternoon put on the play they had rehearsed that morning. It wasn't Cats Now and Forever, as it is today. They'd have to change the play every day. And when the actors, at the end of the day, after the performance was over, would go off and do whatever actors do, drink, carouse, who knows, Shakespeare would read and write late into the night. And that meant that he was writing for actors he knew really well. And there are even traces in the surviving texts that come down to us of Shakespeare writing the names of his fellow actors like Will Kemp or others into the speech headings so that he was thinking of the people who are going to be performing these parts as much as the characters themselves.
Do we have anything that survives in his own hand in terms of manuscripts?
There's one disputed manuscript, and I don't talk much about it in the book because I really wanted to present evidence that was incontrovertible in the book. There's a manuscript which many, if not most, Shakespeare scholars believe was partly written by Shakespeare. It's a play called Sir Thomas More. And I don't know enough to speak with full confidence about that. Otherwise, we have no letters that have come down from him. We only have his signatures, six signatures that have come down. We have a letter written to him. And we have lots of testimony about him by contemporaries. So we don't have that kind of personal information. We don't have a diary from Shakespeare. On the other hand, we don't have diaries from almost anybody in the 16th century because people didn't keep diaries then. We don't have personal essays written by him because nobody, except for a tiny handful, were writing personal essays in that time. So part of the problem is a lot of stuff doesn't survive. The other problem is we expect anachronistically certain kinds of things to have come down to us after 400 years, but those those documents don't exist and never did.
You mentioned that we have plenty of accounts about him by his contemporaries. None of those accounts seems to include anything that would challenge the veracity of his authorship.
No, everybody in his own day, you know, spoke of Shakespeare as the author of Romeo and Juliet, the poet who wrote Venus and Adonis, Ben Jonson, who knew him about as well as anybody in the professional writing world, speaks of him in glowing terms and critical terms as a great writer and somebody with small Latin and less Greek. Jonson didn't hesitate to criticize Shakespeare's limitations, but he also acknowledged his greatness and had a great deal of admiration for him, loved him, Jonson said, on this side, idolatry. And there's no question, unless you believe in a very, very complicated conspiracy theory, that all these writers were suborned somehow to make up this testimony about a man called Shakespeare. It's clear they were writing about somebody they knew, admired, worked with.
Is he unusually little known for a literary figure of his day, or do we have a great deal more information about Christopher Marlowe and Ben Jonson?
Yeah, that's a great question. We know more about Marlowe because Marlowe went to university, which Shakespeare did not, and he worked for the government as a spy, so those kinds of records survive. And Marlowe was murdered in 1593, so quite a bit of information, legal information, inquest, coroner's report, and the like, survive about Marlowe. If you take other great writers of the day, John Webster, Thomas Kidd, we know almost nothing about these individuals. So compared to the 15 or 20 active professional playwrights writing in the 1590s, we know tons more about Shakespeare. But again, it's not the stuff we want to know.
Now, there are people, Jim, who say that Shakespeare couldn't have written this because he lived a relatively provincial life. He didn't, as far as we know, travel outside England. Are the details that he wrote about in writing about other cultures and other countries and writing about, you know, the intrigues of courts, are they perfectly reflective of historical details so that a man of his background could not have guessed them?
You know, that's another great question, and people point to the plays that are set in Italy, a half dozen or so of Shakespeare's plays are set there, and assume that only someone who had traveled in Italy could have written these plays. And there's a very easy answer to that. One, if you look at the allusions to Italy, they're the blandest, most generalized type. And the other thing is, if you wanted to know about Italy in Elizabethan England, you could simply head down to the docks, wait for a ship to sail in from Venice, buy somebody a couple of rounds, and ask them about the tales of what Venice or Mantua or Verona were like. And remember, Shakespeare is using sources, literary sources, which also provide details about these places. So you don't have to live it to write it, despite what they might tell you at the latest writing school in Iowa or elsewhere. In those days, people used their imagination and what they read or heard. So the argument that Shakespeare had to be a nobleman because he writes about court, or had to have been a woman because he writes so insightfully about them, or had to be a sailor because he writes such great seafaring scenes, can go on and on. He had to have been either everything or none of those things, except for what he was, which was a writer with a terrific imagination.
He was essentially born too early to have been told that he had to write what he knew.
You know, I often imagine an Elizabethan writing school where Kit Marlowe and Will Shakespeare and Thomas Kidd were asked to bring in what they're working on, and the teacher said to him, well, Kit, what do you have for us today? And Marlowe says, well, I'm working on this play about a Scythian shepherd named Tamburlaine who takes over the world. And his teacher's saying, well, Kit, have you been to Scythia? No. Have you been a shepherd? Do you know what that's like? No. Have you conquered the world? No. You know, it's just the kind of things we think of about contemporary writing were not the ways in which Shakespeare and his fellow writers for the great Elizabethan stage went about creating. It just didn't go down that way back then.
What can we make of the fact that Shakespeare's one document that does exist that seems to be quite famous is his will, where he leaves his poor wife his second best bed and doesn't mention manuscripts at all?
You know, there are two great things about that. One is, and that's one of the reasons why I called my book Contested Will, because that's the point of entry for so many people into what kind of man would leave his wife a second best bid. The first thing you have to acknowledge is we don't know what that second best bed was. It might have been their honeymoon bed. It might have been her favorite bed. We just don't know what really it meant by saying the second. It might have been the guest bed. We just don't know. It could have been an insult. It could have been something she had requested. The other thing you have to know about Shakespeare's will, and those who want to deny Shakespeare's authorship make way too much about this, is that there was an inventory attached to that will that would have listed Shakespeare's possessions, presumably books, manuscripts, and other valuable things. And his son-in-law took that inventory and went down to London to have the will approved. That inventory is lost. If that inventory had survived, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now because no one would have doubted Shakespeare's authorship. So part of the problem for me is that key bits of information just did not survive. There's no reason why they should have, and maybe one day it will turn up. But for the moment, all we know is there was a will. The will didn't list the objects because the inventory did, and that's lost.
James Shapiro is my guest. He's Larry Miller Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. His new book is called Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us to ask a question by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Joined now by Senior Producer Jeff Whittington. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. What a great conversation. And especially, you know, I personally, when the weather starts to change, here in North Texas, I start to think about summer Shakespeare and sitting out in the, on the lawn. And I think Shakespeare Festival of Dallas is one of our member rewards partners here at KERA. So when you join the station by calling 888-694-6931, there are probably some Shakespeare-oriented benefits that you can take advantage of as a member of KERA. You can also, if you join at the $120 membership level, get your very own copy of Professor Shapiro's book, Contested Will. James Shapiro is one of the he's sort of like, in my mind, he's like the Think resident Shakespeare scholar.
It's nice to have one.
I like to have him on when he has a when he has some new work like this, and it's a really fascinating story, fascinating conversation.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number to call. You can support KERA at the $120 level and choose if you'd like to receive a thank you gift of a copy of Contested Will. As we always say, you can go out, and we do encourage you to go out and buy the book if you want it right now. But this is a good way to kill two birds with one stone if you so choose. You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. So far in this spring membership campaign 2010, more than 1,200 people have made contributions. We greatly appreciate each and every one of you. And if we had the chance to say to you personally, thank you and shake your hand, I guarantee that we would love to do it. We, however, are still asking for your support. You make that call, you decide what the station is worth to you, and what it's worth to be able to spend your lunch hour with a preeminent Shakespeare scholar like James Shapiro, to be able to interact on the phones and via email and ask your questions, have this great learning that is unduplicated anywhere else in North Texas.
Yeah, that's what that's why we do the show, is so that you have something that's interesting to listen to. And then a couple of times a year, we do these membership campaigns, and we say, hey, remember all that stuff that you listened to over the past several months or years?
All that stuff
you
learned?
Yeah. Why not support it with a tax-deductible contribution to KERA? Call 888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Participate in this membership campaign. We only do three a year. It's a very efficient way to make the money, to raise the money necessary to run this public radio station.
Someone who understands our budget perfectly makes up these financial goals for us. As soon as we are finished, we will stop. We're not trying to get rich here. We're just trying to ensure that we have the funding required to serve you and to serve North Texas. We ask that you call now 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about Contested Will with James Shapiro.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James Shapiro. He is Larry Miller Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University. His new book is called Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So we have some background now about Shakespeare's day. Let's jump forward through the centuries here and talk about what was happening in literary criticism in the early 20th century when all of these doubts sort of came to a head. What kinds of texts were being re-examined at that point for their meaning and for their veracity?
The turn occurred 200 years after Shakespeare died. For 200 years, no one doubted that Shakespeare wrote the plays that went under his name and were published under his name. But around 1850, the ground began to move. And it began to move for a couple of reasons. The most significant reason dates back about 50 years before that to about 1790 or so, when for the first time somebody argued, in the absence of enough information about Shakespeare's life, that his life could really be found in the works. In other words, that his works were confessional and autobiographical. And once those floodgates were open, people began to say, hey, somebody else's life fits the stories that we find in these works better than Shakespeare of Stratford's. By the 1850s and 1860s, a number of candidates like Francis Bacon and other aristocratic candidates were suggested as the main authors of these works. And by 1900 or so, heavy hitters like Mark Twain, Helen Keller, Henry James, Sigmund Freud were all believers in the argument that somebody else had written these plays.
What did Freud have invested in the idea that the guy who wrote, for example, Hamlet, must have had parent issues?
Freud, I love Freud, and I grew up reading Freud, and I have enormous respect for him as one of the great geniuses of Western culture. That having been said, he had a problem with Shakespeare. When Freud was coming up with his great Oedipal theory, he was also reading biographies of Shakespeare. And one of the things that he was reading in the late 1890s was a biography by a man named George Brandes, who argued that when Shakespeare wrote Hamlet, he was reacting to the recent death of his father, John Shakespeare, and he was undergoing this terrible Oedipal crisis as he was writing this play. Now, Freud was himself undergoing a terrible Oedipal crisis at the recent death of his father, and he suddenly discovered that he understood not only what Hamlet was experiencing, but what Shakespeare himself must have experienced in the creation of Hamlet. And he identified very powerfully with that. And it helped him actually convince himself that his Oedipal theory was right and alternative theories were wrong. Now, all this worked fine until about 15 years later when George Brandes came out with a new book that pointed out that Shakespeare's father actually died after Shakespeare wrote Hamlet. Freud was confronted with a terrible choice. Either he was going to have to acknowledge that his theory rested on this shaky foundation, or somebody else wrote the plays. Freud was happy to believe somebody else wrote the plays and went to his grave urging that the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, was the true author of the plays, in part because de Vere's father died young and his mother remarried, just as the story went in Hamlet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones and speak with Patrick in Richardson. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, great show again. My question is really quick, kind of. Where did William Shakespeare secure his knowledge of modern French, Italian, Spanish, and Danish when I've just read as well that Ben Jonson, who, you know, I guess wrote the Shakespearean plays, said that the actor knew small Latin and less Greek. And then on top of that, I've heard his daughter Judith was illiterate, even up into the age of 27, could only give her Mark. Why would a daughter of Shakespeare not be taught how to read? And then on top of that, are there confirmed ciphers in any of his texts or Ben Jonson's texts?
Those are three great questions, and let me work them backwards. The first question is the cipher question. There's been an enormous amount of effort and energy paid to trying to locate ciphers or codes in the work of Shakespeare or Jonson or any of their contemporaries, but mostly Shakespeare. And a good percentage of my book is devoted to these cipher hunters. Unfortunately, no one has ever been able to demonstrate that there are such ciphers. And there's a really extraordinary book for anybody interested called The Shakespearean Ciphers Examined. And it's written by William and Elizabeth S. Friedman. William Friedman turns out to be the most important person in the 20th century, or perhaps ever, in the study of codes and ciphers. And he began his interest in ciphers working to try to figure out whether Francis Bacon had encoded ciphers in works that had been attributed to Shakespeare. He ended up discovering that this was not the case. But more significantly, it launched him on a career that put him at the center of the United States government's study of ciphers and codes. And he went on to break the Japanese code that enabled the United States to win the Battle of Midway and the battle in the Pacific. So when people ask me, you know, what does it matter, this Shakespeare question and contested will and all that, the truth is we may not have won the Battle of the Pacific if not for Shakespeare's codes and ciphers explored. That having been said, there's just no evidence, and William Friedman makes that very clear in his book, although people are convinced, and every day or every month a new book or article comes out arguing for a new code or cipher discovered in the works. There's a lot of projection that goes on. Let me just take one of the other questions,
yeah,
if I could. And that's the question about Shakespeare's learning. And there's often a lot of exaggeration or misunderstanding about that. People say Shakespeare only had a grammar school education, and that's true to a certain extent. Grammar school education then was very different than what we would think of as a middle school or grammar school education now. Shakespeare was more accomplished in Latin than a typical university classics major is today. The other mistake people make is assuming that the day Shakespeare stopped formal education is the day he stopped reading or writing or studying languages. Shakespeare and many of his fellow playwrights who also did not go to university were accomplished in reading foreign languages. And if you know Latin that well, French and Italian are not as difficult as they might be for those who don't have those languages. Shakespeare also read tons of material in translation. So too much is made of that learning. These are not learned texts in the way that Ben Jonson's are. And as somebody who's been reading and teaching these plays for 25 years, I know them pretty well, and I have some knowledge of these languages. There's nothing in the argument that Shakespeare lacked these languages that persuades me that he didn't write these plays.
And what about the idea that his daughter was illiterate?
Literacy is a funny question. Almost everybody in post-Reformation Protestant England was able to read. Writing was a skill that fewer people exercised because they didn't have to write. Everybody had to read. They had to read the Bible. But many people listening in probably can speak French but have more difficulty writing it, or studied Greek at some point but can't write it as well. We don't know enough about the education that Shakespeare's daughters received or about the way they made their mark. So a great deal is made and assumptions are taken to conclusions which are unwarranted based on that kind of information. We just don't know enough about Judith to say with any certainty whether she could read or not, or why she might have made the mark the way she did.
Going back to this question of ciphers, Jim, can you tell us the story of Orville Ward Owen?
Orville Ward Owen is a brilliant man who probably had half of Shakespeare committed to memory, who was a physician in Detroit. And like a lot of others who was bitten by the Shakespeare code, devoted his life to uncovering the secret code that would prove somebody else wrote the works. And on his deathbed, he warned others, don't make the mistake that I did. I've ruined my life and my livelihood pursuing this fantasy. But it got to the point where he had proven to his own satisfaction that not only were the plays written by Bacon, but the codes revealed that they were buried in iron or tin boxes in a river, the Severn River on the border between England and Wales. And he went there, and at great personal expense, had the river dredged so that he could uncover these lost manuscripts, and of course, there was nothing there to show for it. it's a sad story. The book is filled with sad stories like this about people who were committed to finding codes or ciphers, or committed in their hearts as a matter of faith that Shakespeare could not have written these plays.
Delia Bacon is another sad story.
Delia Bacon is one of the most underrated Shakespeareans who's ever lived. She was born in Ohio in a log cabin in the early 19th century, Congregationalist family. Her father died, and her brother ran the family back in New Haven when they returned back east. And by the time she was in her 20s, she was lecturing to co-educational audiences, really knew Shakespeare about as well as anybody did at that time, was friends with Hawthorne, Emerson, was charismatic. And in the wake of a disastrous love affair, began to become convinced that the way to redeem her life and spend her energies was to prove that somebody else had written the plays. She published a work called The Philosophy of Shakespeare Revealed in 1857, which was the first book arguing that somebody else had written the plays, and a year or two after that lost her sanity and died. But she is one of the central figures in the story of my book, and had she not veered towards denying Shakespeare's authorship, she'd probably be remembered as one of the great Shakespeareans of the 19th century.
James Shapiro is my guest. He's Larry Miller, professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia. His newest book is called Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We're going to take a quick break here for a couple of minutes to remind you that this is our spring membership campaign. We say membership, really it's a fundraising campaign. You become a member by donating money to the station, so that KERA can continue to bring you unique programming of substance from a variety of different perspectives that never tells you what to think or how to think, just gives you the opportunity to, as the show is titled, think. Jeff Whittington is here with us now. The telephone number, Jeff, 1-888-694-6931. We have heard from lots of people so far this drive.
We have. We've heard from a lot of you. Thank you so much if you've contributed to the station. However, we're still in the membership campaign. It's still membership week. There's still the chance for you. This is your opportunity to get on board with KERA. Just like Shakespeare needed patronage in order to get his work done, KERA needs your patronage. We're not looking for a few wealthy supporters, however. We're looking for everyone to get involved because you use the service. You enjoy what you hear when you turn on KERA and you tune to 90.1. You get something out of this service, maybe not just this show. Maybe you listen all day long. Maybe this is one of the times you listen during the day, and you listen in the morning and in the afternoon, or maybe you use the station on the weekends as well. Well, it's always here for you, and this is one of the three times a year that we ask you to be here for your station. You can join the station for as little as $35. You can give as much as you'd like, $3,500. You decide what's right for you, but please decide right now to go online to kera.org or to call 888-694-6931.
If $10 a month makes sense to you, you can become a member at the $120 level and receive as a thank you a copy of Contested Will. That's James Shapiro's new book about who wrote Shakespeare. Of course, a thank you gift is not, we're not selling you this book. It's available in the bookstore. It's a great story, however, and we won't get to all the fascinating tales that Jim goes into in the book in this hour. So you'll definitely want to pick up a copy. You can do that while supporting KERA when you call us at 1-888-694-6931. You can also do this online at kera.org. Just sometimes it surprises people when I mention that we here at the station, as far as I know, pretty much all of us on staff are members of the station, meaning we draw our paychecks from here and then we turn around and we join the station. There's no requirement to that. We're not told by anybody that there's no pressure, but we all believe in the product. It's something that we use all the time and believe in it enough to turn back around and support it.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, you're right. It's not a requirement. But Chris and I are members of the station. We wouldn't ask you to do anything that we haven't done ourselves. We think it's important that everybody who uses the service gets on board. It's about taking responsibility for the fact that you listen, you use KERA to help yourself stay informed, to help yourself be a better citizen. You get, you know, the tools. If maybe you get the tools for your informed citizenship here, maybe you sharpen them here when you tune to KERA. But you get something out of it, or you wouldn't be listening. You wouldn't listen day in, day out. You wouldn't come back. You wouldn't be listening now during a membership campaign. Please consider what you get from KERA, what it's worth to you and your friends and your family, and what it does for society to have an unbiased, intelligent voice, news service, information service that's not beholden to large corporate interests and advertisers. It's only beholden to you. You're the only one we have to please. So show us that you're pleased and you're happy by supporting the station right now.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also do this online at kera.org. Maybe you could do a dollar a day. It works out to $365 a year, obviously, or I guess this is not a leap year, right? So it's $365 a year. That is what we call our day sponsorship level, which I think if you are interested in receiving a sort of thank you other than just the programming itself, it's really a cool one.
Yeah, if you join in this drive, though, since this next year is a leap year, right?
No, 2011 is not a leap year.
Okay, it's 2012, I think, is the leap year.
Okay.
So you can still get it for 365 this drive.
Such value.
Next spring, it'll be 366.
Act now.
Save that dollar.
But you get this cool thing when you join this way. Right?
What are we talking about?
You get it for the day sponsorship.
Oh, yeah,
you get
a
message.
You get some messages announced on the air, such as, today's broadcasting is made possible by Chris Boyd because she's a day sponsor today, and she wants to say hello to everybody and go Horned Frogs or something like that.
Right. You could say happy birthday or happy graduation or happy anniversary or as long as it's not a commercial message and as long as the day that you choose is not already spoken for, that can be your thank you gift, which I think is really cool.
It's reasonable. You know, $365, it's a dollar a day. Use your credit card and you can get that day sponsorship. But you have to call to do it, 888-694-6931. Or check out the other thank you gifts, including James Shapiro's book, available again at the $120 membership level. Of course, you can go get it for $26 at the bookstore. We encourage you to do so if you'd like it. But you can support the station today at the $120 membership level, and we will thank you with your very own copy. Again, the number 888-694-6931, or contribute online safely and securely at kera.org. And thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can distinguish yourself professionally and personally. Evening classes are available in Plano and Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Larry Miller, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, James Shapiro. His newest book is called Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Max in Grand Prairie. Hi, Max.
Hello there. I have a question that I would love for the professor to comment on. We now know, I believe, that we have authentic paintings of Shakespeare from his time, life paintings, and does he think that these have been probably damaged by cleaning? I'm just very interested in this subject, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, do you know the paintings?
Thanks, Max. I know about the various paintings that have been claim to be Shakespeare, and there's quite a bit of divisiveness among Shakespeare or between Shakespeare scholars on the subject of whether these are indeed Shakespeare. And there's the so-called Cobb portrait, which was discovered or claimed to be Shakespeare last year. My own feeling is quite conservative when it comes to images of Shakespeare. There are only two images of Shakespeare that date to his lifetime that we can be really certain are of Shakespeare himself. One's that famous woodcut that appears in the 1623 first folio that is not a very well-executed image that Ben Jonson describes in a poem facing that picture as to the life of Shakespeare. It's an accurate representation of what he looks like. The other is the bust in Stratford-upon-Avon in in Shakespeare's church, looking over where Shakespeare is now buried. And that one's not much better either. People look at it and say he looks like a pork butcher rather than a great artist. And since then, there have been a lot of different paintings, including the famous Chandos portrait that hangs in the portrait gallery in London. I'm not really convinced any of these are of Shakespeare. A lot of them have been touched up, as Max suggested, since Shakespeare's day. So I'm skeptical about this. We really don't know what Shakespeare looked like. But as with the authorship controversy, what people think Shakespeare should have looked like or want to believe looked like tells us more about their fantasies than necessarily anything about the man himself.
What put Mark Twain in the anti-Stratfordian camp?
Mark Twain really, really, really believed that you had to live it to write it. And he, when he was still on the Mississippi River, on those riverboats, had begun reading Delia Bacon's book and arguing about it. So his entire creative life was one in which he was wrestling with the Shakespeare question. Twain was so committed to the belief that you could only write about what you had experienced, so that when he decided to write a book about the gold rush in South Africa, he hired what we would probably call a ghost writer to go over there and live the experience for Twain, and then come back and live in Twain's household and be debriefed about his experiences. And the man, his friend, did this, a journalist who had some experience as a prospector as well, and kept careful notes, and on the crossing back to America, accidentally stabbed himself in the mouth with a fork as he was eating, and it got infected and he died. And because of that, Twain never wrote that book. But it tells you how committed Twain was to the notion that you could not write something that wasn't firsthand. And because Twain felt there was too much legal language in Shakespeare, only somebody with legal training could have written the plays and poems, he refused to acknowledge Shakespeare's authorship. And one of the last things Twain ever wrote was a long, long and not very memorable work, Is Shakespeare Dead?, claiming in fact that Shakespeare did not write the plays.
We know, of course, that Twain and Helen Keller got to be good friends. Was this one of the things they talked about?
They did. We have, and I write about, a weekend visit that Helen Keller took with John Macy and Macy's wife, who was the teacher to Helen Keller, up to Twain's house. And they were very excited about a discovery of a cipher in a new book. And they were all convinced that this was going to explode the Shakespeare myth. Helen Keller went back and typed the manuscript that's got to hold and examine in the American Foundation for the Blind in New York. And it's still unpublished a century later, arguing that Bacon wrote the plays and not Shakespeare. And she really wanted to publish this, and her publishers refused to do so. They said, Helen, basically, I'm paraphrasing here, protect your brand. This is not going to help you. Stick with memoir. That's what's made you so successful. And that manuscript has languished for the last 100 years unpublished. But she and Twain and others were believers.
Back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. This time we speak with Alex in Dallas. Hello, Alex.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious, has anyone looked into, I guess, the idea that maybe Shakespeare's works were biographical instead of autobiographical? I mean, maybe he, I guess I don't know if he had any proximity to Bacon, but I mean, could he have drawn inspiration from Bacon's life instead of his own?
Alex, that's a good question. What did Shakespeare's work have to do with his times or the lives of those who were living and prominent figures in his day? There are very few moments in Shakespeare's plays where he refers explicitly to something going on at the time or to a prominent figure. You may recall at the end of Henry V, in one of the choruses, there's a reference to the general of our gracious empress, that General Essex, leading an army against Ireland at that time, and Shakespeare's chorus pauses and speaks about Essex coming back from Ireland with rebellion broached in his sword. That's one of those very, very, very few topical moments in Shakespeare. Do I think Shakespeare's writing plays about Francis Bacon or the Earl of Oxford or Queen Elizabeth? No, he's writing plays about Julius Caesar and Henry V and Coriolanus. His two main sources are Plutarch's Lives of the Greeks and Romans and Holinshed's History of England and Scotland and Ireland. And he was not writing about contemporaries. He was writing about distant lands and distant figures. Of course, he was writing for contemporaries for whom the issues in his plays were significant. But no, I don't think he was writing topical biography, nor do I think he was writing autobiography.
Do you think, Jim, that we've fallen victim here to our, I guess the phrase is almost deification of Shakespeare?
I think two things. One, yeah, we think of him as Garrick said in the 18th century, the god of our idolatry, and we can't fathom the gap between the humble origins and the literary divinity. The other problem really is we live in an age of Oprah or an age of memoir, and we assume that everything written in the past as well as the present is autobiographical. Now, if you look at a lot of great 20th century novels and poetry, whether you're thinking of Philip Roth or Sylvia Plath or any of your favorite authors, they do wax autobiographical. They do explore themselves. But when you go back 300 or 400 years, that's not the way authors wrote. So part of the problem that I explore in this book is one of anachronism, that we want to project onto Shakespeare's age assumptions that govern our own, but they just don't obtain.
And so it is a problem. It's more than just a harmless sort of misconception, you think. It keeps us from fully understanding Shakespeare if we believe things that as far as you have seen, are not true.
I think it not only stops us from thinking about the power of Shakespeare's imagination, but it goes beyond that because it rewrites the history of that moment. I'm thinking of something that's come to my attention since having finished writing the book, the disaster movie expert, Roland Emmerich, who has most recently filmed 2012, 10,000 BC, a great disaster movie maker, is coming out with a movie next year called Anonymous. And it's going to be a disaster for anybody who teaches Shakespeare. Hmm. And it's going to argue that Queen Elizabeth had a son out of wedlock and slept with that son. And they had and that son out of wedlock was the Earl of Oxford, and she and Oxford together produced the Earl of Southampton. And in a complicated way, this story explains why Shakespeare didn't write the plays, but Oxford did. And
That sounds preposterous.
Well, it is, and it's going to be a major motion picture coming to a theater near you. And every teacher out there who teaches Shakespeare is going to have little Johnny or Jane come to class and say, "Excuse me, Miss Smith, but I just saw this movie. Shakespeare was illiterate. The Earl of Oxford wrote those plays, and your entire history of the Elizabethan age is wrong." And in the great game of rock, paper, scissors, movie beats book. My book is not going to slow down this impulse to have people believe that this is how the plays came about.
James Shapiro is Larry Miller Professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia. His new book is called Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? Jim, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
I had a great time, and I look forward to doing it again in about 5 years or so.
Sounds great. We appreciate all of you who have participated in the show this hour by listening, by calling, by sending an email, and especially we are thankful to those of you who have called to make a contribution of financial support. The telephone number is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online and make your pledge at kera.org. And these days we call them pledges, but in fact, because the vast majority of you pay for these with credit or debit cards, you don't really pledge so much as just do it.
Yeah, it used to be, you would you'd call up and they would get all your information, and then they'd send something Pony Express.
It did not work so well.
And you'd have to count out the silver dollars and send them back. But now, it's so easy to use your credit or debit card. Your contribution goes to work right away when you do this.
Your doubloons don't wait.
Exactly. And the station can quickly, move forward. It actually saves the station a lot of money when you use your credit card or your debit card, because we don't have to send you an invoice and pay the postage, you know, to your place and back. So it's a great deal. But, of course, we will send you an invoice if you'd like. You can also set up a sustaining membership. But your dollars do go right into the operating budget for all the excellent programming you hear on KERA when you use your credit or debit card. When you call 888-694-6931 or do it online at the very safe and secure KERA.org website.
We do have copies available of Jim Shapiro's book, Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare? This book was actually recommended to us by someone here on staff, Jerome Weeks, who said, you've got to read this. It's amazing. And sure enough, it is. It's a terrific read if you like this sort of thing. Whether you agree with Shapiro or not, I think you'll find it very, very interesting. And there's a lot in here that he sort of takes apart. You can buy the book anywhere. It's in all the bookstores these days. It's online. But we would love to be able to send it to you as a thank you if you will make a $120 contribution right now. Of course, what happens is we buy the book, we deduct that from what we earn, and we send it to you, and then your contribution comes out to whatever the balance is. So if you want to do it the other way, that's fine too.
Yeah, make a $94 contribution and then go get the book for $26 at your favorite literature retailer, whether it's terrestrial or online. It's totally up to you. But we hope that, because it's totally up to you whether or not you support the station, we hope that we can do something today to convince you to join the station. It is the spring membership campaign. We are working our way toward our overall goal of $700,000, and that's what we've got to raise to keep the station moving along at the right pace for what it costs to bring you the programming. Every contribution counts. Every single one of you who joins the station by calling 888-694-6931 or by going online to KERA.org can decide how much the station's worth for you. And you give that amount of money, and you know what? That's it. That's all you got to do to get involved. And it is necessary that we hear from you because this is how it works. And the minute we raise that last dollar of the goal, the drive ends. We go right back to the regular schedule. You won't hear from us again in this capacity until next fall. So please do your part right now.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org.
It is 90.1 KERA Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. Also 100.1 K261 CW in Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR in Wichita Falls, and 99.3 K257 EV in Sherman. And, of course, you listen online as well at kera.org. You get all of your favorite NPR shows, PRI shows, American Public Media shows, and your favorite local news reports and programs right here on KERA. Please support it right now at 888-694-6931.
We are a not-for-profit organization, different maybe from some of the other great organizations that you might support with your money. We serve you all the time. The money that you spend with the station goes directly back to you in the form of programming. Of course, it also benefits a lot of other people, makes the community a richer place. It's hard to imagine life without KERA, and I say that I'm pretty confident that I can say that not only for us who are here on staff and work here as volunteers, but for all of us who listen to the station. And look, I know how it goes. You're driving around in your car, you hear us talking about fundraising, you hear $700,000, and you think, gosh, I hope those people, I hope everybody else gives some money out there. And you might even be sort of wishing that good things happen to KERA. It happens when people who believe in it take action. It really is. It's one of those things that if you believe public radio should exist, if you believe that it's a value to the community, it really is, I would think, sort of an ethical obligation to support it. Now, you can decide, maybe you just want to kick $10 our way. That's fine. Maybe you can do $1,500 and become a Friends member. Maybe you're somewhere in between. That part is up to you, and we won't even tell you what the amount should be. But we really strongly believe that everyone who listens should make a contribution, large or small, to keep the station strong.
You know, when you hear those spots a couple of weeks out from the drive, say, would you like to help out KERA? You can come and answer phones. And, you know, when we hear those spots, we say, oh, yeah, the pledge drive's coming up. When you hear those spots, you go, oh, the membership campaign, oh. But really, and you know, everyone knows what we're going to say before it starts. We're going to say, you know, call the number, give money to the station, do your part. It's important. We've got to make the goal. And it's going to go as long as it goes because that's how it works here. Wouldn't it be great if everyone who was going to pledge or was going to contribute to the station, rather, let me use 2010 language, we just go ahead and contribute, and we just get the darn thing over with. That's what can happen if you call right now. We're actually waiting to hear from you at 888-694-6931. You know what we're going to say. We're going to try to say it in as many different possible ways over the next as many days as it takes to get it done. But you have the answer with your phone call.
How many times do we need to say it? I guess we'll know at the end of the drive. It's a little bit like getting my kids to take out the trash. You know, at some point we'll say it and it'll happen the first time around. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also make a contribution online. You can check out thank you gifts there, including Contested Will, Who Wrote Shakespeare by James Shapiro, available at the $120 level. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.